years.
I hate Rusty when he's been
in quite a few board meetings over the telephone.
To the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, March 11th, 2015, will come to order. Start out with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on the Olmsted Plan. Commissioner, you want to come up to the table, and who else do you have with you? Welcome, Commissioner, and just tell everybody your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I am appearing before you today as the chair of Governor Dayton's Olmsted subcabinet that was established by executive order. And with me today is Darlene Zangara, who is the executive director of the Olmsted Implementation Office, which was established in late 2013. We are here today to provide you with a very brief overview of Minnesota's Olmsted Plan. The reason that we were requested to appear before you is that you will see several budget items, both from Minnesota Housing and from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, that are part of the governor's proposed budget for various aspects of the Olmsted Plan. And we thought it would be helpful for you to have an overview of what the plan is, how it works, and how these budget items will fit once you get to acting upon them. So with that, you have a copy of the PowerPoint in your files, and we also have it up here in the screen. So why does Minnesota have an Olmsted Plan? I find that many people have heard the word Olmsted, and it is, in fact, has nothing to do with the place that Rochester is located, and in fact, it is spelled differently than Olmsted County, but that's a common misperception. Olmsted refers to a U.S. Supreme Court case of some 11 years age called Olmsted versus L.C., and it is an Americans with Disabilities Act case. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it's unlawful to keep people with disabilities in segregated institutional settings when they can live in a community setting. And so that's the underpinnings of what is referred to as an Olmsted Plan. Minnesota's plan really came about at this particular time because we agreed, as part of the Jensen versus Minnesota Department of Human Services settlement of several years ago, that we would write an Olmsted Plan, and the plan was provisionally approved by the court that is overseeing the Jensen case and the implementation of the Olmsted Plan in January of 2014, shortly after it was submitted.
So how is the Jensen case related to the Olmsted case?
There is no Minnesota Olmsted case. As part of the settlement of the Jensen case, the state agreed to draft an Olmsted plan, which would talk about how the state of Minnesota would more broadly implement some of the principles of the federal Olmsted decision.
And the Olmsted decision is applicable to all the states?
That is correct.
Okay, so we have our own lawsuit, Jensen versus the Department of Human Services, which is basically the same thing as the Olmsted case.
No, I would disagree with that, Senator. Okay. It really... The Olmsted case federally was a much broader case, and there's a lot of belief that the federal Olmsted case requires states to write an Olmsted plan. It actually does not, but Olmsted plans have emerged in various states as a result of subsequent state lawsuits. In the case of Minnesota, we voluntarily agreed as part of the Jensen settlement to write our own Olmstead plan. So the courts did not write this plan. However, because it was part of a settlement, the courts are overseeing the implementation of that plan to ensure that we are proceeding with what we said we would do in the plan.
Okay.
Thank you. Just as an additional piece of framework, the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibit discrimination against people with disabilities, and under both state and federal law, government entities are required to ensure that all people with disabilities can access services and programs. So that's really the underlying framework for the Olmstead plan. So what is our plan in Minnesota? It really is a comprehensive roadmap, and by comprehensive, we have some 200 action items within that plan to provide services to individuals with disabilities in the most integrated setting that's appropriate to that individual. And one of the things that we heard as we took public testimony around the state during the development of the plan is that it really is about providing choices to people. Some people will choose to live in the community with supportive services. Others may choose to live in a congregate setting. So it really isn't about moving from one to another. It really is about providing individuals with disabilities with effective choices. The goal of the Olmstead Plan is to ensure Minnesota will be a place where people with disabilities can live, learn, work, and enjoy life in integrated settings. So many aspects just deal with the physical ability of people with disabilities to use certain facilities and services. The plan is designed to be comprehensive, specific, measurable, and timely. So there are many deadlines in the plan. There are many benchmarks that we have set out in terms of moving people from segregated settings into integrated settings. And it's really designed to have a positive impact on the lives of people with disabilities. Sounds simple? It's not. The plan was initially submitted to the court in November 2013. The subcabinet was actually formed by an executive order in January of 2013. And the initial plan was provisionally approved in January of 2014. There have been some revisions that have been requested by the court, and that revised plan was again provisionally accepted by the court just this past January, January of 2015. So what is the plan? What's encapsulated in it? The Olmstead Plan outlines seven important domains of a person's life: employment, housing, their health care and healthy living, community engagement, that is the opportunity to get out into the community and engage with people both with and without disabilities, transportation, lifelong learning and education, so that includes not only our education but our higher education and also career development, and supports and services, which are the various federal and state-funded programs that provide services to people with disabilities to assist them in needs that they might have. Each of the domains, in order for a person to really be successful, has to be on track for that person. So sometimes a person may live in an integrated setting but not have access to transportation. So it really takes all of the seven domains to really work for people. And the plan lists goals and key activities in each of these seven domains. So that's kind of the way we organize our thinking within the plan. So who's involved with the plan? There are eight cabinet-level agencies that are included in the subcabinet: corrections, education, deed, health, human rights, human services, transportation, and housing finance, which match up pretty well with those seven domains. Also represented on the subcabinet is the head of the Council on Developmental Disabilities and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Again, this subcabinet was established by executive order of Governor Dayton initially in January of 2013, and then the governor issued a revised executive order in January of 2015, which put a little more detail into how the subcabinet would conduct its business and also made it clear that the Olmstead Implementation Office would report to the chair of the subcabinet. Also, it changed the manner in which the chair of the subcabinet is designated, and that is now designated by the governor rather than spelled out specifically in the executive order. The Olmstead Implementation Office, which was established late in 2013 and for which this legislature provided some funding in the supplemental budget bill in fiscal year 2015, has several very important overarching responsibilities that play across all of the agencies. One is simply accountability for the plan, and that's related to compliance with the plan. Because this plan is being overseen by the courts, it's a fairly regimented process, and the role of the compliance staff, which also reports to the chair, is to monitor the plan for completeness, timeliness, and sufficiency of the response. That last one is really important because the court has articulated certain expectations about these action items, and the compliance staff makes sure that whatever documents might be produced or training materials or whatever are responsive to what is written in the plan and what has been asked for by the courts. It also provides coordination among the agencies. It has the primary responsibility for engagement with the community. Darlene, as the director, is frequently asked to speak to various community groups about the Olmstead Plan, and also coordinates activities among the many councils and committees that exist within the state that are related to groups representing different disabilities and different interests within the disability community. And finally, the Olmstead office will be responsible for something that's laid out in the plan, which is a quality of life survey, which will essentially track individuals over a period of several years to gauge whether all the activities that we're engaging in are in fact improving the quality of life and the access to more integrated settings that is the goal of the Olmstead Plan. So what's currently happening with the plan? I already mentioned the governor's executive order in January, which really took our 2 years of experience working as a subcabinet and spelled out a lot of a bit more detail on how we do our work. Just yesterday, the subcabinet met and adopted a set of operating procedures that we will use for our actions going forward. Our reports to the court, which have been numerous and at times a little bit contentious, but I am happy to say that we are now on track to become timely on all of our reporting requirements and also much better in judging the sufficiency of the materials that are submitted. Regular subcabinet meetings are being held every other month with special meetings as needed. And probably the bulk of the work of the Olmstead Implementation Office is in working with the individual agencies and tracking the progress against the plan. So to wrap up our comments and to tie it into the duties of this committee, I provided just a subset of the Olmstead budget package for this year. And you'll note that there are several items on the budget that are in bold, and those are the items that will come before this committee. There is also a handout in your package. There are two. One has a slightly larger set of budget items, some of which are related to Olmsted, and some of which are in the spirit of Olmsted. So it gives you a little fuller picture across a number of agencies of things where it will be helpful if those items are funded in implementing the overall plan. But what you have in the slide in front of you is what the governor has put forth as his Olmsted budget package.
So, Commissioner, in the spirit of Olmsted means we'd like to have it funded, but it's not being proposed right now for funding, or what does that mean exactly?
No, I would say, Mr. Chair, that it is more programs that have been ongoing for some time that have a small portion of them that are related to Olmsted, but the bulk of the activity under those programs has an ongoing purpose, and the nexus to Olmsted is smaller. That's why we refer to them in that way.
So those programs have been around for a while, but they could be related. They could help us in implementing Olmsted, or they could help us in saying that we're doing what Olmsted requires. Is that what you're saying?
That is absolutely true, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. So going back to the items that you are likely to see, ensuring statewide Olmsted plan compliance is a very important part of what the Olmsted Implementation Office and the Ombudsman's Office and the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities. Those are all items that will help us to ensure that the actions that are set forth in the plan, which again is being overseen by the courts, will actually occur and will occur in a timely manner. We then get into the more, what I would say, programmatic items in the budget. And what you have heard testimony on from DEED is improving employment opportunities, which is funding for their individual placement and supports program, and also funding for extended employment. And I know that this committee has already heard from DEED on those two items. Under the housing category, one of the items you won't see here, but will be heard in the Human Services Committee, which is a major item, which is reforming the program that is generally known as group residential housing. And that will reform that program to allow individuals with disabilities to separate their services support from their housing rental assistance support. Very important initiative that I hope will be approved by this legislature. And then finally, the item that you have seen in the Minnesota housing budget is for a program that we call Bridges. This is a long-standing program that's been funded by this legislature to provide rental assistance for individuals with serious and persistent mental illness. And this additional funding that is being requested by the governor will allow us to serve approximately 200 additional people over the next biennium. These items that you see in front of you are only the change items. This does not include the base budget, but just the change items that are proposed. So with that, I have concluded my comments. And if you have questions, I'm happy to take them, or you can contact Darlene. We are happy to provide the context that you need to review these various programs as they come before you.
Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, for that. The Bridges program specifically,
yes.
you just mentioned, so there's going to be an additional 200 people that are served. What are they doing now? How are they being served now?
Mr. Chair and Senator, they are generally in segregated settings, so various kinds of group facilities and state institutions. So we are looking to provide the kind of community supports they need to live successfully in the community, and the Bridges money actually provides rental assistance for them to be able to afford the units in the community that are available.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner, so has the court finally approved the Minnesota plan, or are they still reviewing it?
Mr. Chair, the court has conditionally approved the plan. They have told us some things that they'd like to see as changes to the plan, and that revised plan will be submitted to the courts on March 20th.
Okay. Is there any indication that the revised plan will encompass the amount of money that we're looking at right here, or that it may need more money?
Mr. Chair, we have tried to be careful in the writing of the plan to indicate those items that are dependent on additional resources.
Okay. Darlene, do you want to add anything?
No, I think she's covered everything. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. So now when we see Olmstead in the budget, we know what's going on, you guys. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate it. Senator Saxhoff. We'll get that taken care of.
Okay.
Senate File 1114, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1114 will help Minnesotans with disabilities continue to have access to quality job placement services and on-the-job support services through the Extended Employment Program. Senate File 1114 provides $2 million for the biennium to maintain the current extended employment system that is maintained by deed. The bill also sets aside another $12 million for extended employment providers to better assist people with disabilities for the pending Olmstead transition costs, which will shift Minnesotans with disabilities into more community-integrated job settings. With me today are Karen Johnson, Executive Director from Task Force Unlimited, and Lisa Parte, Director of Waivered Services from Functional Industries Incorporated, to give brief presentations and help answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, who wants to go first? Then just say your name for the record.
I'll start. Thank you, Senator. My name is Karen Johnston, and as Senator mentioned, I'm the Executive Director of Task Unlimited in Minneapolis. And we serve over 300 clients in Ramsey, Dakota, and Hennepin County who have serious and persistent mental illness. I'd like to thank Senator Saxhog, chief author, and Senators Tomasoni, Dietzick, and Anderson as co-authors of this bill. I'm here representing extended employment providers and MORE, which is the Minnesota Association of Habilitation and Rehabilitation Organizations. We're a coalition of providers, 100 agencies strong, that provide services to thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities. And we're asking for this allocation for extended employment because it hasn't been adequately increased for inflation since 2007. These dollars assist us, community rehab programs, in helping people with disabilities find and keep jobs. Clients at Tasks are making no less than minimum wage, and in some cases, $15 to $16 an hour, giving up their disability benefits because their work supports them. So they're paying taxes, living in their communities, and in most accounts are considered quite successful. I gave a 40-year job award to a Tasks client last year. That's pretty remarkable for somebody with schizophrenia. Tasks clients' recidivism rate back to the hospital is less than 1%. We believe it's because of the jobs and the support they're given, in part due to the help of this funding. But according to some of the new rules, as you've seen by Olmstead, these jobs won't be considered competitive employment. There's now a push towards funding more competitive employment in integrated settings, as you heard from the last report in Olmstead. And while we support competitive employment in principle, we want to make sure that client choice isn't something that we take away, that it truly is client choice. The Supreme Court Olmstead decision, the federal program changes, and pending changes to the extended employment rule will create costly changes to the extended employment system. And not all people with disabilities are able to hold down a competitive job or even want a competitive job. We don't want to leave these people behind. And we're very concerned about the folks in outstate Minnesota, as job opportunities are generally less available. While we appreciate the governor's $500,000 in the budget to extend for extended employment, we do this is non-Olmstead dollars, and we are asking for $12 million in transitional dollars to help us make these transitions to Olmstead and make sure we provide the services to people with disabilities to help make these transitions. We want to make sure that clients have choices, and they're their choices and not the choices we tell them they are. I'm here to introduce Lisa Partey to offer some other examples of challenges with Olmstead, and I want to thank the senators again and the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Partey, and I am the Director of Wayward Services at Functional Industries in Buffalo, Minnesota. Functional Industries is an organization which provides an array of employment opportunities and services to individuals with disabilities, both developmental disabilities and mental health disabilities. We serve individuals in Wright, Sherburn, and Stearns counties. Among the services offered, we offer extended employment services, both center-based and community-based. Functional Industries has been a longtime supporter of Olmstead in giving individuals as many choices as possible for work settings and supports. In 2010, we were awarded a $500,000 grant from DEED for a project named Enduring Vision. This was a pilot program that was set in motion to determine what it would take to move individuals from being served in the extended employment center-based program to community-based employment. The time frame involved with this initial project was approximately 17 months. As a quick overview of the project, there were 182 participants. Of these 182, 97 completed intakes into the Enduring Vision program in hopes of obtaining community employment. 77 individuals chose that they didn't want to leave center-based employment, and 8 did not even complete an intake process. Of the 97 who completed intakes, 20 obtained community-supported employment. Out of the 182 who participated, 96 are now employed on community crew sites. The remaining individuals were either moved to more intensive services that better met their needs, or they terminated services and are now remaining at home. Some of the significant findings with this project, which relate to why we're here today, are as follows. There are significant barriers to obtaining community employment, such as individuals' lack of flexibility with their schedules, transportation, individuals choosing not to participate, and at times guardians creating barriers to the process by not returning paperwork in a timely process. Not to mention transportation when you're living in a rural area. On a funding level, it was found that there was just not enough money to fund the supports necessary for success in the time frame that we had. Therefore, some individuals whose needs were too high to support were transferred into programs which could provide those more intensive staff supports and increase training opportunities. These programs that they were transferred into are funded under the Health and Human Services budget. And unfortunately, as I understand it, the Health and Human Services budget is now being cut back, which will again limit the supports that can be provided to these individuals. After the completion of the Enduring Vision project funded by DEED, we, as a company, we sought private funds to continue the project. We were able to see success with the project, not only through the $500,000 originally granted, but through the support of Wright County and the Bremer Foundation. Unfortunately, you know, the public sector will not be able to assist all of the extended employment programs across Minnesota. Public sector funds are limited. Of course, of those who did not have access to waivered funds, one gentleman's now sitting at home without services because he does not have any funding source to pay for those more intensive services, and he doesn't qualify for voc rehab services. The irony of the situation is that while we have been working so hard to move people into the community to be employed there, sometimes the opposite effect happens. There are many individuals we serve in our extended employment program in Greater Minnesota that have needs that disqualify them from voc rehab services. This is Mary Ann. Mary Ann is one of these individuals. She has cerebral palsy and is confined to a wheelchair with very limited physical abilities. However, her mind is very sharp. She's very concerned about her future and the Olmstead plan. She's has very real concerns that her future may consist of sitting at home without work because there are few employers who would hire her at her level of disability. And in her exact words, "Work is very important to me. Without it, I do not feel good about myself. Who would hire me? I don't want to end up sitting at home." Thank you for your time.
Okay. Any questions, comments? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, the first lady that spoke, yes. You talked about those persons with a disability that may not want a job. How is it that you help them, and what are the reasons?
But they may not want competitive employment.
May not want competitive employment.
So there,
explain that a little
right
further.
Now in the extended employment rule, there are three categories. There's a center-based category, which is one of the things that Lisa was talking about, where people can go to a center and they can help bag candy, or they can put items in a bag for a manufacturing firm.
Like a DAC center?
Exactly, yes. Okay. Then there's another level called community-based employment, and the community-based employment is in old language, people working together in crews and doing things together that way. There's a different rate for each one of these levels. The competitive employment, by definition right now, is that they have to be paid a wage equal to that of a non-disabled person and be in an integrated setting. But not everyone is capable of being on a job and being paid a rate competitively because of their disabilities, and some can't or don't want to because of the stress. For instance, some people with mental illness would prefer to work on a crew in the community with others with mental illness because it is less stressful for them. And while we believe wholeheartedly that competitive employment is the ultimate goal for many, many people, we don't believe it is or should be the goal for everyone because not everyone is able or wanting to be at that level.
So, Mr. Chair, to that point, so those people would be in either a group setting or a workplace setting?
Center-based.
Center-based. So they would be in one of those two categories as opposed to competitive jobs or?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. Right now, there is center-based employment, community-based employment, and competitive employment. Those are different rates in the extended employment rule, and those are options right now under the rule. Under the Olmstead ruling, the Olmstead ruling is requiring the extended employment rule to cap community employment. Center-based employment is already capped. Our concern is that some of these funds may disappear over the long term because of the pressures on the push towards competitive employment.
So your advocacy is to, or at least bring attention to the need in some circumstances for group group community employment and center-based employment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
And so let me drill down a little bit further on the scenario where somebody doesn't want work. You also testified about how gratifying it was. I think it was Mary or the example you used. What do we do in a scenario where maybe somebody says they don't want to work, but frankly, maybe they should be working to the skill level or the ability they can because of those gratifying and beneficial attributes of not just sitting around home? Is that what you're referring to, or did I misunderstand in some of those cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think you understand. There are individuals that, yes, you are correct, are capable of working in the community, but at this point maybe are choosing not to. And it's those people that are going to take more time to be able to bring them around to seeing that the opportunity in the community is greater than the opportunity at center-based. What's lacking is the funding. We tried to do that with this initiative through DEED and found that there just, one, wasn't enough time, and two, there wasn't enough funding to be able to make that incredible push out to the community. But there are people, such as Mary Ann, who have big concerns with who's going to hire her. Her level of needs are such that she may need to be toileted on the job. She may need some extra supports that an employer is not going to provide. And she wants to be sure that if she has to work in the community, that those supports are going to be there for her.
Sure, sure. Well, and I raise the issue because I think it's a bigger question than what we need to get into here. But I to create a mindset among some that maybe they don't want to work for fear of the unknown. We don't want our incentives to be such that they want to create that mindset and not go to work, because I think there are, as Mary Ann has given you her testimony, there's very, very beneficial reasons why we should try to help employ these folks. And so persons with disabilities can have the same gratification and success and goals and dreams in their lives, which is why I think you're here. But I want to drill down a little on this because your statement and what can we do to help promote those that are maybe fearful of going back to work to get back to work and give them opportunities so they can achieve and realize the same success and gratification that everybody else has with the purpose that goes along with the job and the skills that they do at work. And so I just pontificate a little bit on this, but I think you're moving in that direction, and that's I guess maybe the point I wanted to make. But
and Mr. Chair, Senator, I just want to add that the extended employment system is an outcome-based system. None of the providers get paid without outcomes. We get paid after we provide services. I think that's an important point. And we are here advocating on behalf of people with disabilities and employment. That is what we do. And I, speaking from tasks, a 40-year job award, our clients love to work, and they don't want to give it up. And these funds are very important to us as an agency and to them as clients in helping to support them on their jobs. And we wholeheartedly agree with what you said is getting people with disabilities employment.
And Senator Sacksog, your language, and I forget, or clarification, says Minnesota Diversified Industries is eligible for funding under this paragraph. Is that the only one that receives it, or why does it say is eligible or is an eligible company to receive funding?
Senator Sacksog.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's one that we know of that has done the job, and we want to qualify them.
So are they the only ones that would get it, or would another company offering a similar service or nonprofit also be eligible? It doesn't read to me as it's exclusive to just them. It's just saying that they are eligible, but others would be as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator, currently MDI is providing services but is not covered under the extended employment providers. There are, I think, 24 of us currently that are getting extended employment funds, and MDI is not. And because they are doing the work and providing the work, we wanted to include them in the funding bill.
So I don't read the language.
We are adding them.
You're adding them. It's
yes.
not exclusive to
Correct.
Just them. And if ABC company comes forward next month or next year, they could possibly receive some of the funds through DEED as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if they qualified under the extended employment rules, yes.
As far as criteria of what services they provide, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you,
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dealing with the Olmstead Plan, and I understand what they're trying to achieve, but in putting the caps on center and community-based employment that are being placed, are we running the risk of at some point creating the lack of necessary employment opportunities for this segment of our society? Because we're pursuing a goal that is not obtainable for some people?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would agree with that somewhat. I would say that there are individuals that it would be very difficult to support in the community in a placement. And when you're in Greater Minnesota and jobs are not plentiful, and you're talking about placing people who are like Mary Ann, who have severe disabilities, it's going to be very difficult, and you're going to limit their ability to work. I don't want to say that everybody should be center-based. I don't agree with that. And I think what's shown through the pilot program that we did is that with a little bit of education, the individuals we serve understand that there's more out there. And we've been extremely successful in the fact that even after this has ended, we have taken our center-based and moved 182 people off of our work floor out into the community, either on community crews or community placements. Unfortunately, our community crews do not pay minimum wage. They are at subminimum wage, but there's tiers to getting out to the community, and some people just can't. It's going to be impossible.
Those crews that went out to the community that are getting less than minimum wage, are they paid based on their ability to do the work? I just had a meeting in my office the other day about advisors watching people and rating them and trying to determine whether or not they actually have the ability to do the job that they're trying to do. And if they aren't proficient at it, they cut their wage in half. And in this case, the person went from $4 an hour to $2 an hour, which I thought was outrageous. But is that the kind of stuff that happens here too? Or
Mr. Chair, subminimum wage is very regulated. And how things work is when we go into a community crew site, we do a time study with someone who actually works there to see their productivity rate and how long it takes them to do the job. And then we come back, and that's the person that we're serving, their rate of pay is prorated according to what they can accomplish, if that makes sense.
Got cut from $4 to $2.
Well, it's really based on what they can produce. So as we like to tell people, the more you can produce, the more you get paid. And we do have individuals who have figured out that if I do X amount of parts a day, I can earn minimum wage, and that's their goal.
But do they get paid based on their production, or do they get paid on what was observed, the day that they were observed, and then
they
for
get
6 months?
They get paid based on their production.
Okay, so that's different than what I heard. Okay. Anyway, all right. Did I see Senator Westrom? You got your hand up? Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, and two questions. The community crew jobs, can you give us some examples of what would that be? I mean, cleaning up parks or setting up hockey rinks. Just give us an idea of what kind of jobs are we talking about there, and then I have a follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Senators, community crews can be anything from cleaning crews. We have crews that go out and clean the local DOCs. We have crews that clean the churches, local churches. We have crews that go out and have built retaining walls and done landscaping. We also have crews that go out and work in places like Federal Cartridge in Anoka packaging bullets on a daily basis. We have some that go out to other places and do different kinds of assembly work for the company themselves. So it's a vast array of things.
Okay. And to the point, I think Chair Tomasoni was talking about, I had some folks in my office this week as well talking about it. I've toured some of the opportunity centers, DACs, back in my area. And one of the things that was shared with me this week was and maybe the easiest way to get our minds around it is one of the DACs has a contract with a large conveyor company, and they need to put lots of rollers and parts together, and so they put rollers inside of the Teflon rings that they run on, and they base that on how many they can do. And so if a normal production would be 60 an hour and they can do 30 an hour, that would be the base of their pay for that person with those skill sets. And some can do it at 60 an hour, some can do it 30, and some can do it more or less than that. And that's how they calculate the pay. I know they have lots of different contracts like that, and it seems like a great opportunity for folks that can offer that skill. But that's my understanding of how they break down the pay as well. Is that right?
Chair, Mr. Senator, yes, you are correct.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Ingram?
Just real quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've toured these DAC and opportunity centers, and they're tremendous. The different contracts that they work with is quite interesting, and to say the very least, it's a wonderful thing that they're able to be out and working in some capacity. Have you ever? The question where I'm going here is: have you ever put the numbers to, and maybe you even mentioned it in your presentation, that if we don't have this opportunity for these people, are the Is there physical or I'm thinking about medical expenses? Do they incur at larger rates if you're not keeping individuals' minds working and their hands working and then be able to work? I mean, if they're staying at home, is it costing more for us? Is what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can answer. I think that as I mentioned earlier, TAS Unlimited works with people with serious and persistent mental illness, and we truly believe that. The jobs are a large part of what are keeping our clients out of the hospital. A recidivism rate of less than 1% on an annual basis for someone with serious and persistent mental illness is saving taxpayers millions of dollars. 1 month in a psychiatric hospital is thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. Our clients are giving up their disability benefits because their jobs are supporting them. So there is a large cost to taxpayers when people are not working.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, if I could also add, Functional Industries was part of a research project with Dartmouth and Johnson & Johnson revolving around mental health services and how we provide supported employment to individuals. And that model in and of itself has found that if individuals with mental health are working, their mental health is more stable and they are in a much, much better place. The answer to your question is yes. There would be an added cost.
And just to follow up quickly, and that's the thing I think people don't think about, this investment would seem rather small, quite frankly, compared to what would be the outcome if we didn't have this. So thank you for the work you do.
Okay, any other questions? Not then, Senator Sachs, anything else?
No, Mr. Chair, I'd ask this bill be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, so we'll lay over Senate File 1114 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Good testimony. Senator Schmidt. Senate File 486, Senator Schmidt, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Persons Employment Services Appropriation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to hear Senate File 486. In 2014, the legislature created in statute the grant programs that Senate File 486 would fund. These grant programs would focus on two areas. First, specialized statewide grant programs to provide long-term supported employment services for persons who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. And second, school-based communication, access, and employment services for youth who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. I have copies of the grant program if you'd like to see those. Again, that was adopted in 2014. And what Senate File 486 would do, again, is fund these programs at $1.2 million in each of the next 2 years, 2016, 2017. With that said, we do have some testimony, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to hear that.
Okay. Whoever wants to go first, go ahead, but just say your name for the record and then just start your testimony.
Hello. My name is Cynthia Benson. And I would like to say, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank Senator Schmidt for being the chief author of Senate File 486 that would provide support for deaf and hard of hearing students, support and employment for transition aid students and adults. I grew up in Africa, in Liberia. I moved here in 2005 when I was 11 years old, and that's when I started to learn English and American Sign Language, and I really struggled all through high school. It was a big challenge for me. I never had a job. I didn't have any work experience. A lot of bosses and companies don't hire people who are deaf and hard of hearing because they're worried about the communication barriers. And there was a lot of communication struggles at home, too, that I never learned certain things from my parents. After high school, I wanted to go to college but realized I wasn't ready for that. So I went to a transition program at Vector, and that's where I gained some work experience at a hotel and at a library. I had a job coach at both of those sites that gave me the skills that I needed. I mean, I didn't know a lot of those basic job skills because I wasn't born here in America. So I learned those on the job. After both of those work sites were completed, I got in touch with the Minnesota Employment Center, where a specialist helped me fill out a resume, did some mock interviews, did some practices with applications. And with my employment communication specialist, we went to a job fair where I met with Macy's, and I thought that would be, you know, kind of a good place for me to work. So I gave them my resume. They emailed me all the steps that I needed to take to apply, but filling out that application was pretty tough. The English and the language and the vocabulary was kind of hard for me to understand. So with the help of MEC, they helped me fill out my application. And I sent that in, and I went into the interview at Macy's with one of my school interpreters and the specialist from NEC. And the interview went great, and I was offered a job. But at that time, the boss didn't really know how would I communicate on the job. I'm deaf. And so MEC really kind of facilitated that and helped them understand the accommodations that I would need to be successful on the job. For example, I have a name tag at work that says my name and that I'm deaf and hard of hearing. So if customers come up to me, I just point to my name tag. And really, communication hasn't been an issue. But at that time, I was just hired seasonal work during the holiday season. And so when the Christmas holiday was over, I wanted to continue working, but I didn't know kind of how to make that work. So again, I got in touch with the specialist at Vector, who works at MEC, and they helped me get in touch with HR and take the steps that I needed to take to continue working there. And recently, they just called me back, and I have a part-time job competitively. Deaf and hearing people really are the same. We can all be successful on the job. It's just that deaf and hard of hearing people just have those communication barriers that we need to break through to get there. So I just want to say thank you for listening to my story today.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the witness? Okay, who's next?
Hi, my name is Carrie Roseanne Scanlon. I live in Maple Grove. I work as a human resources and training specialist for GEM Technical. We're based in Orono. We design and manufacture custom controls and valves for fluid power applications. In our machine shop, we employ about 25 operators and machinists. A few years ago, we hired our first operator who identifies as deaf. The occupational communication specialist has really been instrumental in allowing that employee to be successful at our company. For example, when we hired him, we had a lot of support with our management team, but our first shift lead was really concerned that he would need to learn sign language in order to be able to communicate with our new employee. And our specialist was able to help show him that he could provide information in a written manner in a specific way that would be easy for our employee who's deaf to understand. Our specialist is also helpful in having our employee understand basic job skills in regards to coming to meetings on time, punching in and out correctly. And over time, we had to move our employee from a first shift position to our weekend shift position, and the specialist came in and helped the weekend shift employees be more comfortable with working with somebody who was deaf, and then was also instrumental in helping our weekend shift lead understand those written communication methods that were going to best help the employee and the lead communicate information back and forth. Since then, we've hired a second employee who's deaf who works on our second shift. He had more experience, so his onboarding process was a little bit quicker. But one thing we had was a perception that he didn't want to be helping his coworkers. And so our specialists really worked with the employees on the second shift to understand through very basic hand gestures that they could ask for help, but then also worked with our employee to help him show other people that he was observing what was going on and he was noticing if people needed help and was trying to help. So it was really a communication issue between our employees understanding what he was trying to do and our employee, who is deaf, trying to understand how our employees were feeling about him. Because in the end, he did want to be helpful, and we worked through those issues. Beyond that, the occupational communication specialist has really just tried to help our employees integrate into our overall workforce. She often encourages them to attend company functions, company potlucks, and those things so that they do feel a part of the organization that we have. So in closing, I'd just like to say that we do hire sign language interpreters to come out once or twice a month, and they're very helpful as well. But the difference really is that the occupational communication specialist takes the time to make sure the information going back and forth is well understood. So it's really diving down or digging deep so that our employee is truly understanding the information that we're providing to him, and that our employee's questions or concerns are being conveyed correctly back to us. And that's really how the specialist is making an impact at my company.
So the written form of communications, are they pen and paper, or are they on a computer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, they are written. What our specialist has explained to us is that for the employees that we have, English is like a second language to them because sign language is their first language. And so the word order of things is a little bit different in sign than it is in English. So she's explained to us that word order differences so that when we're writing our notes, they're easier for our employees to understand.
Okay. I don't know if you know this, Senator Schmidt, or one of your witnesses know this, but how do we handle this type of thing in rural Minnesota where it apparently doesn't have these services that are offered in the metro area?
Now, Mr. Chair, that's a great question. Obviously, there are talented and hardworking Minnesotans who happen to be deaf, deafblind, or hard of hearing throughout the state. I would defer to one of the witnesses or testifiers if there's anyone in the audience who'd like to answer that question. I know that that's one of the reasons we're asking for this funding, though, is to make sure that these resources and services are available throughout the state. And so, as you can tell, there's some great stories here.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Hartnett with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. Great question. This service has only been available in the metro area, and actually it was in the base for many years, almost 20 years, and then in 2011 went out of the base, and they've had to compete for these funds. They are confined right now with the services they provide through a competitive grant process to serving in the metro area. And there's a fiscal note from last year, and that's where the $1.2 million comes from. We checked with the different providers to see how much it would cost to provide services in greater Minnesota. And to extend out to greater Minnesota, that encompasses the $1.2 million, that there would be an opportunity for the Minnesota Employment Center to establish offices and regional offices to be able to establish those relationships with employers and employees who are in greater Minnesota.
And were the services provided in greater Minnesota before 2011?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, people have had to move to the Twin Cities in order to be able to get their services, in order to be able to obtain these transition services that are valuable. Families have left their jobs in Bemidji from across the state and moved to the Twin Cities to obtain them. So they have not been able to be provided because there hasn't been the funding provided, and that's what we're hoping to do with this funding.
But before 2011, were there services in rural Minnesota?
I believe there was a pilot that was funded for a temporary period of time in Duluth, Minnesota. Those are very successful, but the funding was not continued.
Okay. Sounds like part of the rural agenda here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, mm-hmm. I'd throw that in there. All right, any questions or comments for anybody on the committee? Okay, Senator Schmidt, any final comments?
Just thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for hearing the bill today, and we hope we see this again later this year.
All right, then we'll lay over Senate File 46 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all very much. By the way, a quorum is present, and Senator Kerr, would you come up?
Okay, next is Senate File 394, Assistive Technology Grant Establishment and Appropriation. Senator Thomas Sony, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. On Senate File 394, I have an A1 amendment to put it in the shape that I would like the bill to be in. So I'll move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I think everybody has it in their package.
Does everybody have the A1 amendment?
Yes. Except for senators.
Okay.
Don't move, Mr. Chair.
So Senator Ingebrigtsen moved that A1 amendment be adopted.
We have to vote on it.
Pardon me.
Like the way we do things.
I suppose I'm the dictator here. Mr. Chair, I move to adjourn now that we have
Okay. I withdraw.
Backtrack.
Once again,
Senator Ingebrigtsen moved that the A1 be adopted. Any question from committee members? Okay. All support of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? Okay. So the A1 amendment is moved. All right. Here we go.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, the Senate File 394 is an assistive technology grant establishment and appropriation. And the proposal would appropriate $2 million to provide a grant through deed to the Assistive Technology of Minnesota, which is a statewide nonprofit organization that addresses issues of access to and the acquisition of assistive technology. The purpose is to ensure continuation of the only statewide program providing access to dedicated funding for assistive technology devices and services through a low-interest loan program, which leads to self-sufficiency, creating pathways to careers while promoting independent living for participants. Assistive technology is an item
piece of equipment or a system, whether acquired commercially, modified, or customized, that is commonly used to increase, maintain, or improve functional capabilities of individuals with disabilities. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn this over to my witnesses.
Okay, please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carol Fury, and I am the CEO of Assistive Technology in Minnesota, otherwise known as EquipaLife. This grant that we are requesting is a one-time request to continue a low-interest loan program that began in the year 2004 with federal funds that seed-dollared the program, so to speak, to get started in Minnesota, a program dedicated for assistive technology, adaptive equipment, and another program. So there are two different loans, one for adaptive equipment and the other for employment-related equipment. Now, we've heard most of the afternoon about employment and the needs of individuals in employment. Assistive technology can make the difference between a person having a job and a person not having a job. Getting to work is one of the number one issues that we hear about constantly. Our loan programs have assisted over 600 people to access equipment, including about 400 vehicles. It's the number one item that we see people coming to us for assistance for. And of those 400 people, 375 needed those vans for employment. The other 25 were related to families with children. As their families grew, as their child grew, they no longer could carry them into their vehicles. We do pool resources from other public agencies to help individuals. For example, the waiver program that individuals were referring to before, and or rehab services would possibly pay for part of the modification of a vehicle, or they might pay for a portion of equipment for a farmer. So we reach everyone from babies all the way up to people who are aging in Minnesota. We pool the money with other agencies to help them reduce the amount of money they need for their loan. We have been very successful. $6.6 million in loans have been provided over the past 9 years with a zero default rate. There's not a bank or a credit union in the state of Minnesota that can stand up and say that. We came to the Minnesota legislature when we first received our funding, and we needed to raise $550,000 as a match. The legislature did provide us with part of that match, about $100,000. We were able to raise the rest of the match, as in your notes, if you would like to reference them, which was $550,000 total. So we raised $450,000. Right now, we're on a campaign to raise $4 million. The $2 million that we're asking for from the state would be one half. We have the capacity to raise the additional funds. We've been operating for 9 years, expanding our programs to sustain our ability to carry on other activities while we maintain the loan programs. There's something I'd like to show you. Excuse me, Roger. You go back just a little bit.
Can someone help?
No. See this?
Yes.
Everybody's waiting right now. We have no money right now to help the 35 people that are in this box, their applications. There's not 35 in the box. It's just an example. Okay? I wanted to show you. These are real people who have real needs. Without continued funding, the program will go away. We wrote a grant to the Federal Department of Education for $668,000, and we're waiting for their response in 2015. We received the top score of any applicant, so we do have the ability to raise our $2 million. Employment is a big part of what we do, and I do want to spend just another minute talking about employment. We worked with the University of Georgia on a study, whereas they took the results of our employment project, which actually is a one-to-one program, helps people start their own business, work from home, be flexible, look at the person's desires and interests to create careers and meaningful jobs. We have 125 people who are no longer on public assistance as the result of the $1 million loan program. The average or mean age was 38 years old of this group of 125. University of Georgia came back to us and they said, giving a T score of plus or minus two or three, all the statisticians, you're saving the government and the taxpayers approximately $1 billion per person over their lifetime. That is the impact that people that the people who receive the services have the right tools to do their work, are able to get to work, and seek a career that they're interested in and they want to work. We have several people who've been labeled unemployable, and they are completely employed. Members of the committee, we're at a critical juncture. We ask for your approval today. I have a couple people here who would like to tell their story. This is a very, very important program. It is the only one in Minnesota. There are 36 programs like this throughout the country, and we're rated number 3 across the board, apples to apples, and I'd say that's pretty good for a small little nonprofit organization, especially with the low default rate.
Thank you, Ms. Furry. That's a very good story that you share.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions for me?
Yes, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, can you repeat your default rate again? So I heard that right.
0%
of the 550,000?
0% of our total overall initial investment of all the loans, we have not had one default.
And about how many again were there? In
660.
Okay, and those loans go for adaptive?
Adaptive equipment and employment-related tools. There can be anything in employment from if you're a person who fixes automotives, mm-hmm. To buying your tools you need for that task. If you are a person who needs a specialized computer system, you can purchase that. It doesn't have to be specialized if you just need a computer to do your work at home. The nice thing about the telework, it's called telework, is that it doesn't have to be adapted. It can be anything you need for work.
Yeah.
And that has been an extremely successful program. We spend a lot of time with people, a great deal of time with people, and we follow them. And I believe that the success of that program with the 200 people so far who've been working with us is because we spend a great deal of time and we invest with them. We start at the very beginning with what is it you would like to do, and help them carve out their niche, their path, and their career.
So
Senator Westrom?
A couple questions just mixed together for the purpose. What would you attribute the success of payback to, and in that, what are the size of loans typically, a few hundred dollars to a few thousand dollars? And then how is it that they pay it back, basically through their own income that they produced through their job, and they've just been that dedicated to pay you back? I know there's a few questions in there, but
Ms. Ferrer?
I was trying to keep them as you were speaking. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, other members, because we have such a close relationship with all of the individuals that we work with, we've had people who come up upon hard times. Okay, I had back surgery and I was out of work for a while. Okay, if I had a loan payment, and this happens, if we have a customer who comes to us and they have a hard time, might be hospitalized, they might have some other family emergency or some reason why they are not able to make a loan payment, we have a procedure for rescue payments, whereas the individual signs an agreement with us at the time that the loan is provided, because these loans are guaranteed by the loan fund. And the agreement clearly states that if the person is unable to make a payment for any reason, they must contact us within 5 working days. Also, our lender, our lending partners, we've been very fortunate to have 3 lending partners. Other states are pretty jealous because they can't find a bank to help them, and we have people knocking on the door. So it's really great. So we will rescue that person, and they will pay back their rescue payment either at the end of the loan cycle, or they may pay it back in increments of $20 at a time, $40 at a time, $50 at a time. And that's how we have been successful in keeping the default rate down to zero. We also have a very extensive policy and procedure that we go through with each applicant. We have first go through an internal review with members of the staff and community. And once that's a green light, so to say, because we do all the underwriting that a lender would do. We have the credit reports. We have all of the information on the individual's income. And so we're able to give the board an opportunity then to decide whether or not this loan is approved. We don't approve every loan. If a person is unable to repay the loan, and it's obvious when they have a debt-to-income ratio of 80% and they don't have enough money to maintain their own home, buy groceries, put gas in the car, we try to help them find an alternative. And we've helped hundreds of people find alternatives. We're the funding gurus in Minnesota for helping people find adaptive equipment.
Thank you, Ms.
Does that answer your question?
Yep.
Senator Westrom?
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other question from members? Okay. May the next testifier please state your name.
Thank you, Senators. My name is Chris Wayne. I actually work for Mid-Country Bank, but I'm here with a unique perspective. If you give me a little bit of leeway, back about third or fourth grade, I remember my teacher asking the class, what do you guys want to be when you grow up? And as they went around the circle, we got, inevitably, most of the girls wanted to be Julia Roberts or Michelle Kwan. And almost every guy wanted to be the next Kirby Puckett. Well, they got to me, and I politely asked if I could rephrase the question. Wasn't so much what I wanted to be when I grew up, but what I'd be able to do. You see, I was born with cerebral palsy. And as a result, even by that young age, I had faced a lot of different challenges. My biggest concern was, really, I wanted to be like everybody else. I wanted to be normal. You know, you grow up and you start to figure out the quickest way to be normal is to be independent. It's, as we've heard many times today, get a job, get to the job, maintain the job, do something as simple as going to the grocery store, buying your own groceries. God willing, you meet a nice person, you start a family, you can go pick those kids up from the baseball field, and they can be the next Kirby Puckett. Having that mobility, having that independence, the only way to explain it is it's truly like a gateway to a new world. You find out opportunities that you never knew existed because you're not dependent on somebody else doing everything for you. In the time I've known Carol and ATMN, their knowledge, their expertise, their willingness to go to the end of the earth for everybody that comes. And as Carol pointed, it may be a no to we can't right now give you the loan for the van, but here's the steps that you need to do so we can work towards that. They routinely take what is normally a can-not-do situation for a person who's disabled and turn it into a can-do reality. I humbly ask you guys today to please consider this. Consider it for the dream of mine, for a bunch of other people that we saw today, and for the hundreds and thousands that ATMN will be able to help in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wayne. Thank you. The next testifier.
Yeah, my name is Roger Robinson, and I worked, a little job. Without equipped life, I wouldn't be able to go to work. You know, they helped me get a van equipped for me to drive. You know, I had to get a job once, and I couldn't get to the job, so I had to let the job go because I didn't have no transportation. And I talked to my caddy waiver, and she told me to go find me a van, and she helped me, get it. So she helped me to go through Equip for Life and got me a van, and now I'm able to go to work and, do things that, I'm able to do. Go to grocery store on my own, do things on my own because I live by myself, and I want to be independent.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. Any question to the testifier from committee members?
I'd just like to point out here.
Yes, please.
Chair members, that like in Roger's situation, he uses multiple types of assistive technology. His chair, and I'm not sure what else he has at home, but lives independently, works independently without his vehicle. He wouldn't be one. Mm-hmm. It's really critical.
What other kind of technologies do you use?
Besides your power chair.
I got a specialized type of bed, and my chair, it locks into my car. I got a hand control in my vehicle and everything. I drive on my own. Don't get to go places, because I can't depend on Metro Mobility. Mm-hmm. Because they don't come on time. They make you miss your job.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. I pick out a phrase today about normal is independent, so thank you for that, too. Any comments? Or
Mr. Chair, Mr. Weston? I can't let the Metro Mobility comment go by. We should probably have you, sir, come down to Transportation Committee next offer some perspective on some of those services, because I've fought those for years, and I've often said people with disability have to count on getting somewhere in reasonably fast. And I know what you're saying, because I used to use Metro Mobility, and you had to schedule half your day to just plan for a half-hour appointment, and we can do better than that. So thank you for your comment.
We also have one more testifier from the former union. Is here? Yep. Welcome, Mr. Peterson. Please state your name from the mic over there and proceed on your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we also strongly urge you to consider this legislation. It's very important. Farmers Union started working more with Equipa Life and their program, AgriAbility, several years ago, and it's been something I've been very amazed at. It's always tragic when a farmer suffers an accident. Farming, as you know, is a very dangerous, it can be a very dangerous occupation. And so when we, have members suffer a disability or from an accident, it's always hard, and there's a period of time of can you get back into farming. I always think it's interesting because we see, people, they go through, what are they going to do? Now they've maybe lost their income, you have a farm, you're doing all this activities. And I've really seen the Equipa Life AgriAbility program be able to help farmers get back out on the farm, whether it's putting lifts in the tractor, doing the assessments. It's a very good program, and I think that's something we just want to urge you to consider in this, that it's an excellent possibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any comment from Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, no, I think that this is pretty compelling testimony and how important these types of assistances are for people who need them, and especially in the area of disability. And so, Mr. Chairman, we probably should figure out how to fund this one, too. And so at this point, I think we should lay over Senate File 394 for possible inclusion.
Okay. We'll lay over Senate File 394 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you.
Next is, again, Senator Thomas Sony, Senate File 416, Center for Independent Living Appropriation. And welcome back, Senator Tomasoni. Anytime when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Senate File 416 is an appropriation for Centers for Independent Living. It's a $5.906 million appropriation for the biennium. The proposal appropriates that amount of money for grants to the 8 Centers of Independent Living. Last biennium, the legislature appropriated approximately $5 million. And Centers for Independent Living provide a variety of services, but they focus on four main points. They include information and referral, and in other words, information on accessible housing, transportation, employment opportunities, rosters of persons available to serve as a PCA, interpreters for the hearing impaired, or readers for the visually impaired. The second main thing is independent living skill training, courses on the public transportation system and managing the budget. The third thing is peer counseling. It's a person with disability working with others who have disability. And finally, advocacy. In other words, consumer and community advocacy. And this is another type of service that is provided for people who want to live independently, and it works very, very well. So go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay, please state your name for the record.
I'm Kara Ruff. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Association of Centers for Independent Living, and I'm the Executive Director of Independent Lifestyles in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. Thank you for having us here today, and thank you to Senator Tomasoni for authoring our bill. We're most grateful. As he stated, Centers for Independent Living have been around since the 1970s, and we are so excited to hear all the talk about person-centered planning in Olmsted and things like that, because that's the premise of what Centers for Independent Living have been historically. We are consumer-controlled, which means 51% of our board and our staff must be people with disabilities so that we're governed by those that we serve. There are 8 Centers for Independent Living in Minnesota, so we are talking about statewide coverage or trying to achieve that goal of statewide coverage. Each of the 8 centers has a very large geographic region, up to 9 to 11 counties, and some of us are dealing with both geographic regions and very dense populations. As Senator Tomasoni stated, we provide the core services needed for normalcy, as we've heard others testify, which means independence. And we heard such great testimony about our extended employment services and assistive technology, and I hope that you will support all of those. We need them desperately. However, if somebody does not have the skills to live independently, they're not going to go to work, and they're not going to be able to access or utilize assistive technology for any purpose. They need people by their side assisting them in learning independent living skills training in the areas of daily living, communication, sexuality, self-esteem, goal setting, problem solving, financial management, communication, employment skills. All of those skills must be achieved so that they do have the capacity to go on and work and become part of our quote-unquote normal society. We've been serving, again, people with disabilities, of all disabilities historically. We're a cross-disability organization, so you don't have to go here for one disability and here for another or here for another. All Centers for Independent Living serve people with mental, physical, cognitive, emotional, chemical, sensory. Any type of disability is qualified for services, and we are also age barrier-free. We serve all ages from birth to death. So there is no criteria or referral needed. They don't need to fit within a certain bracket or IQ or diagnoses. They can range from very, very mild to very, very profound disabilities and everything in between. And that's the beauty of it. Centers for Independent Living have historically caught the people with disabilities who fall through the cracks in our society and don't have access, especially statewide, to all of these incredible services that are truly needed to live independently. Without our services, they remain extremely isolated and alone and unable to participate or grow in a meaningful way. The Centers for Independent Living across Minnesota, we spend a large portion of our budgets just on travel because, as we know, there is not transportation in our rural communities, and so it's imperative that we are going out and bringing the services to them and getting them connected with within their own communities and finding resources and opportunities that are meaningful for them. So not everyone with a disability has to move to the metro area. Some people actually want to remain living in outstate Minnesota. Part of our work has included relocation from nursing homes and institutions for people with disabilities who do not choose to be living in one of those settings. There is thousands who are under 40 who fall in that category in Minnesota right now. In the past year, we were successful in relocating 89 individuals. And although it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, if they were to be in a nursing home, that would have cost approximately $85,000 a year, $76,000 if they had a shared room, or $37,000 if they were in an assisted living facility. To serve all 89 of our consumers cost us approximately $66,750, which, as you can see, is a tremendous cost savings to the state of Minnesota. By preventing those out-of-home placements, by transferring people out, we want to be part of the solution, and we are part of the solution, and we save taxpayers' dollars. Again, they might need other waivered services or other amenities to live independently, but even adding those in, we are still a tremendous cost savings for Minnesotans. We have been most grateful for the legislative support over the years, but as with most programs and with all of the issues you have before you, it's always been, you know, a couple steps forward and a step back. And so currently we are below what our funding level was in 2008, and we still are struggling for that. The Statewide Independent Living Council sets forth a statewide independent living plan. And in that plan, it has always been a goal for us to achieve a basic funding level of $500,000 per Center for Independent Living in Minnesota. We have never gotten there. And don't get me wrong, we would be ecstatic and most grateful to achieve that. But that was a goal 20 years ago. So, it's not even really adequate to meet the needs of what we're facing today, but it would sure go a long way in helping. I want to be sure you know that. And again, I think that, you know, Senator Westrom, you made a good point of talking about, you know, why aren't people wanting to work and things like that. So many people with disabilities are isolated. They don't have social skills. They don't have communication skills. They've never been taught how to make healthy or appropriate choices. And so there's a lot of fundamental independent living work that goes into preparing somebody just to be able to be wanting and willing and ready to work as well. We also want to highlight our partnership currently with DEED and the Vocational Rehabilitation Services, in which we have a partnership because they understand the beauty of going to work goes hand in hand with independent living skills training. If they don't have the independent living capacity, they're not going to be successful in their employment. And so we have appreciated that partnership very much as well. So what we are asking for is actually an increase of $692,000 per year to be added to the state-based funding, which would finally bring us up to the $500,000 base funding amount per Centers for Independent Living. You have been provided with a map that indicates the service area for each of the 8 Centers for Independent Living in Minnesota. And the white areas indicate areas that really no services or there's no center presence as stated. But we can also tell you with these huge geographic regions, we can't fully serve at the rates that we're at either. We can't even market our services. We too, I didn't bring my box of files, but I can assure you we have huge waiting lists as well. And it's something that pains us greatly because they are people who are waiting in the rural areas in isolation who really have no other services or supports available to them. And until they can get Center for Independent Living services to help them to become more independent or to achieve their independent living goals, they stay stuck, isolated, and in a state of not very independent living. So it's really critical that we continue to fund these services and supports and better provide a statewide network, my goodness, for Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ruff.
Is that one white area, Senator Westrom's district?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe one of the two of you could answer this. I have a constituent that is wheelchair-bound, works, has contacted me with regards to belonging to an association that comes down to the metro area for meetings, and I'm wondering if, when you talked about 51% of the members having to be disabled, his concern is, and this might be the total wrong place to be asking, but maybe Senator Tomasoni knows, $55 per day per diem has not been increased in many, many years, as well as the mileage rate for those people that are coming down that have to come to the metro to meet. Do you do anything with that, or do you know what I'm talking about? Do you have any members that travel like that? Because
I believe that you might be referring to like the Statewide Independent Living Council or one of those groups, the Developmental Disabilities Council, something like that. Those appointments are made by the governor, and then they do things like create our statewide plan for independent living. That he could be referring to that. I can't be certain, though. We really have nothing to do with that, and that's just a call from the governor who asks for citizens to serve on these committees.
Sure. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up for the information, he said that it has not been increased in many, many years, and I have no reason to dispute that from the $55 day thing, and was wanting me to check into that to see how to do that. So thank you for that information. I'll follow up.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm guessing you'll probably, maybe council can help with this, probably something that would be in the jurisdiction of actually Senator Saxhoff's committee. All the various boards and commissions and whatnot and the per diem rates and that sort of thing.
Senator Saxhoff?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I think it's probably in state government policy, so it'd be Senator Torres Ray's committee.
No, right.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, I'll take it up in transportation.
We'll find out the answer outside of this committee, I suppose.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, I think today was a good day to see all the different services that are available and that are necessary in order for people to live independently with disabilities, and we have a big, big job to get to all of them. And quite frankly, the state's probably underserved right now, and it needs to have a bigger investment. And all of these bills, I think, were good indications of how much we need to invest, and we still are only hitting the tip of the iceberg. So I think this has been a really good day. Before we lay this over and adjourn, Mr. Chairman, I should let the committee know that I think because we're the Economic Development Committee, we can take credit for this, and that is that Gus is now hitting his last day with us, and he's now going to get a real job outside of here. So I think because he served on the Economic Development Committee, we can take credit for for developing a job. So thank you for your service, and good luck in your new job.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Gus, for that, for the service. And
Senator Ingebrigtsen, before you, I as I recall, his name is Gabriel.
There you go. I knew it was Gus. That's a Metzenism right there.
I do a follow-up. Mr. Chair, just a whole different issue. We've been hearing all the budget proposals come forward. I think you yourself had asked the Department of Ag and those folks that came in, you were concerned about, and we should all be concerned about the increase in fees. They were going to get back to us at all, or were they going to come back to the committee
did they ever get us a list?
Yeah.
You sent out. Oh, yeah.
So we have the totals of the increase in fees.
And I think you received an email from me.
Okay. I'll double check. Thank you.
Check on it. Okay. Sometimes this high-tech stuff doesn't work right, so if you didn't get it, let us know. We can send it again. Okay. All right. Okay, so we should lay this over before we adjourn, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We will lay over Senate File 416 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, we will adjourn our EDEM committee.
I remember you asked
the meeting is adjourned.
Yeah, I got to follow up on that.